This is Sean Mulkerin, and I am here interviewing Democratic primary challenger to Albany County District Attorney David Soares, Matt Toporowski. Matt, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk. If you could just start out, tell me why you're running, why you feel you would be great in the job.
Sure. So thanks so much for taking some time and the coverage of the race. You know, I decided to run after I had a case that I was handling against this DA's office. I was representing a young man. I was appointed to represent him. His name was Kaleem Lewis. He couldn't afford an attorney. And he was charged with possessing a gun after police had busted into a house he was staying at, searching for a woman. There's a woman's name on the search warrant. And after searching for a while, they found a gun in a woman's Victoria's Secret clothing bag in a pile of woman's dirty laundry. And Kaleem was sleeping on the other side of the room, but they charged him anyway. The woman wasn't there, by the way. So I met him. We quickly decided that we were going to try this case. It wasn't his gun. He had nothing to do with this gun. During the jury selection, I had made sure he had one of my suits. I loaned him a suit, a shirt, a tie, so he looked his best for this jury to make sure he got a fair trial. But during the jury selection, I quickly realized it was going to be an uphill battle getting a diverse jury, a jury of Kaleem's peers, a jury that reflects Albany, because the black and brown jurors quickly raised their hands. They had bad experiences with this DA's office, and they couldn't be fair and impartial. So ultimately, we were down to two black jurors, a man and a woman. Both said they could be fair, they could sit and serve on this jury, and they had no issues. But the DA's office challenged those jurors and knocked them off the panel for no reason. They had no reason. So I objected. It was a discriminatory challenge. They said they could be fair jurors, but ultimately those jurors were excused. I walked back to my table. I saw Kaleem sitting there. He was tilted over, all hope had drained from his face, just the wind knocked out of him, because he realized that at that moment he wasn't going to get a fair trial. He was a young black man on trial, and we had an all white jury. You know, they went on to convict Kaleem, and he was sentenced to 10 years. And that was a moment, and I've seen several moments like that, where this justice system, as it's set up, has prosecutors that are hell-bent on winning at all costs and not seeking the truth in the situation. They just want convictions. So I decided to run after handling that case, and also thinking back to when I worked at this DA's office, where I had colleagues who had tacked their press release guilty trial convictions on the wall, their guilty plea press releases, their trial conviction press releases tacked to the wall like trophies. And so that culture of winning at all costs, seeking convictions and not the truth, it was there when I was there, and I ultimately resigned from that office. And so, you know, I decided to run to change that and really end these two systems of justice, which we all know exist. We saw it all through COVID. You had Michael Cohen and Michael Avenatti and you name it, if they had power and are white, sailing out of jail. And you have all these people that are just left there that don't have that same access. And so we really need to end these two systems of justice, bring fairness for everybody, end this culture of winning and convictions at all costs, and that's what I intend to do as DA.
So let me ask you, I mean, seeking convictions is not the truth. I mean, that's kind of the entire American system. I mean, it's not, the French system is built upon getting at the truth. So, I mean, how do you think you're going to be able to upend all of legal precedent?
Well, it's really redefining the prosecutor's role and redefining what public safety means. You know, like you're saying, public safety used to mean and traditionally means we are just prosecuting, punishing, and, taking bad guys off the streets. When we redefine public safety to mean that we want to have strong communities and empower people to, you know, sort of police their own communities, help them keep themselves safe, build good relationships with them. I mean, that is how you redefine public safety. And we know that a lot of these issues that lead to the criminal justice system, substance abuse issues, mental health issues, that those are better treated by public health professionals outside the criminal justice system. And so it's an acknowledgement that the prosecutor, with all his or her power, can do much more by also doing less, by actually not seeking convictions and, you know, diverting cases out of the system, not taking cases if the real cause that brought that person to the courtroom was a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. And treating it that way, you are making us safer as a whole, because you're not just exacerbating these underlying issues. You certainly can't deter further crime by simply prosecuting mental health or substance abuse. It's not going to get to the root issue. So it's a real shift in how we're defining public safety and how the prosecutor fits into that purpose.
Well, that rolls into, you know, my first question, which is, you know, what do you view as the role of the district attorney?
You know, the role of the district attorney is to always seek the truth. And I actually had a quote on my wall by Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court justice. He graduated Albany Law School, and he was the Nuremberg prosecutor at the Nazi war trial, the chief U.S. prosecutor. He defined the role of a prosecutor as this: the role of the prosecutor is to always temper zeal with human kindness, to seek the truth and not victims, to serve the law and not factional purposes, to always approach the task with humility. That is the role of the prosecutor. Okay, and what that means is you can be a compassionate prosecutor, you can give people second chances, you can seek shorter sentences, you can address issues like mental health and substance abuse by diverting them out of the system or making sure these people get the treatment they need, and that you're not just seeking punishment and convictions, which lead to mass incarceration, which has led to a 50% higher incarceration rate in Albany County under David Soares. And you really see a complete lack of compassion in the job, and you see less safe communities because you're just destabilizing whole generations of families and people. Because you're just churning people through this mass incarceration system. And so that doesn't make us more safe at all. We need to really rethink, you know, how we're defining public safety and the prosecutor's role.
All right, great. So the rest of these kind of have longer wind-ups and then the question. So the first one is on prosecutorial discretion. Somewhere between 80 and 95% of criminal cases never go to trial. Rather, they resolve in a plea bargain. It's according to the Washington Post. There are about 2,400 elected prosecutors in the U.S. One 2015 study from the Women Donors Network found that in 46 states that elect their own prosecutors, about 95% of those attorneys were white. Two states actually had no elected attorneys, and two others that had elected attorneys, they didn't include because of their limited roles. In 60% of those 46 states, there were no black prosecutors. Prosecutors' discretion to file charges, change or reduce charges, plea bargain, and make sentencing recommendations nearly unlimited, according to the Vera Institute of Justice. You know, and with that discretion, white defendants repeatedly receive more favorable plea bargain deals than black defendants. A study of 48,000 criminal cases in Wisconsin from 2017 found that white defendants were 25% more likely than black defendants to have their principal initial charges dropped to a lesser crime, meaning that the white defendants faced initial felony charges less likely than their blacks. In Hampton Roads, Virginia, a 2016 review of almost 500,000 criminal cases found that of the drug distribution charges, 48% of white defendants received plea bargain deals with no jail time, while just 22% of black defendants got the same thing. And there are a few more of these examples. One more. Specifically in New York State, in that 2015 study, five of the 61 district attorneys were identified as persons of color, eight were uncategorized, and the remaining 48 were white. So does color of a prosecutor's skin relate to how his job is performed?
I would say 100%, 100%. And the question you're really asking is, how do we best address the structural racism in the system, which everybody's aware of at this point, which everybody knows is true. What you have to do here is really, you know, several things. Okay, first of all, what I want to get across to you is, clearly my opponent, David Torres, is black. I'm half Cuban. Okay, my mom was born in Cuba, but I get stopped in the street, no one's going to bother me, so I understand the privilege that I have. But you really got to look at the office. And currently the DA's office, besides Soares, who doesn't handle cases, only has one lawyer of color out of 30-something. And that's a huge issue, because if you don't have a staff that reflects your community, if you don't have a staff from different backgrounds, different races, different sexual orientations, different socioeconomic statuses, and we're talking about the lawyers, these are the decision makers, they are going to use their discretion to really uphold these two systems of justice, which your question just highlighted completely with all those facts and stats, and to really uphold structural racism. And so the question that we should be asking in this particular race is, what is wrong, or what is the issue with the current culture and space at the district attorney's office where they can't hire and retain lawyers of color? And they need to, because you cannot do this job correctly, appropriately, without having lawyers making decisions that affect people's lives and freedom when those people don't have had experiences like the people that are coming into that courtroom before. They need to have lived experience. They need to know where these people are coming from. They need to know that, hey, these people have been stopped because they had the light on their license plate out. I mean, no one really ever gets stopped for that, but if you are a black person, you're driving in certain communities, you're going to get stopped. And so you need prosecutors that know that we have systemic racism, that maybe experienced it itself, and that are focused on addressing it. And in my office, not only will I create that space where people of color feel comfortable, lawyers feel comfortable working and want to be, but I'm going to train them to know the history of how we got to this point. All those facts and stats you just said, that is some history there. And I don't have to come up with it all myself, because Dr. Alice Green, Center for Law and Justice, issued a report recently addressing the major problem of structural racism in Albany County and giving 4 or 5 recommendations on how to address it. One of those was having the prosecutors learn the history of this justice system and how it has enabled the killings of people like George Floyd. How it has enabled that by allowing police to think that they're going to get away with this with brutality. This DA, the current DA, completely ignored that report, did not respond to it. You know, so this is a major issue that we have here in Albany County, structural racism. You lose the community's trust, and you can't do the job. I'll bring up the Elazar Williams case again, another case where we had our own George Floyd here. Young man shot in the back, paralyzed from the chest down. Community demanded a special prosecutor. They wanted truth and transparency in the process. The detective on that case had previously worked with the DA's office investigators, who were former detectives, and was there regularly meeting with prosecutors to prepare for an unrelated case. That is called a conflict of interest. That is called a bias. And the DA here did not recuse himself, and that led to further distrust with this community, and particularly with the black and brown community. So I want to end with this. The identity of the elected always matters, of course, but if the rhetoric on these issues doesn't match the office record, you know, that's where you need to look. Then you have a real problem. And here in Albany, the DA's office has not done anything to address structural racism. They've really helped enable it. They've lost the community's trust. And if you look at the lawyers on the staff, look at who's in the leadership positions, they're not taking this seriously enough, and they absolutely need to. My campaign is diverse across age, race, sexual orientation. I'm going to create that space where people feel comfortable and want to work. I'm going to rely on the relationships that I've built with our community leaders, with local schools. I'm on the board of Green Tech Charter School, 99% black Hispanic boys, all boys. And I take these young men, I bring them to my law firm. They take internships, and we're going to do that at the DA's office. So you are empowering these young people of color, you know, from the get-go, so they can be these powerful actors in the justice system.
So how do you do that? Are you on day one walking in and clearing shop?
you know, I've thought about this quite a bit because I do think that there are going to need to be some changes. I would say to leadership, definitely. But what I want to get across to some of those assistants in there, the line assistants, people who I do know, I mean, what I'm going to come in there and say is, look, if you are committed to a justice reform, if you share this vision that I have, that I ran on, that I worked so hard and that I'm going to campaign on, that I'm going to bring to Albany County, to this office, if you share that, I want you to join me. There's a spot here for you. I'm not in there to let heads roll. I need people. I need dedicated public servants, and I know there are some there that believe in the message. They just need better leadership, and we're going to start with a leadership shift to get to a culture shift, to shift how we view criminal justice, the role of the prosecutor, and public safety in Albany County.
So, I mean, would you commit to actually hiring people below these unit chiefs as persons of color as a way to actually get at changing these roles?
I mean, what I'm committed to is getting lawyers of color from you know, management, more importantly, management down. You know, again, like, you wonder why lawyers of color don't want to remain at the DA's office. You know, you don't have a lot of leadership that look like them. So I'm not, you know, look, I can't get, I'm committed to that because there's no other possibility for me to address structural racism than at least that's the minimum, you know, creating a space where people of color, lawyers of color want to be. I mean, that's bare minimum. And like I said, you go beyond that, you have, again, you can assign reading to these lawyers. You can teach, you can have a historian come in. Again, recommended by Dr. Alice Green, you know, the new Jim Crow book. I mean, people need to know, like, where this justice system has been to know where it needs to go. Because right now, if we look at it, it looks like we're in, you know, 1960 with this justice system. I mean, police officers are literally killing, murdering black people in the street in the name of safety, in the name of public safety. I mean, that's where we're at. So we need to know where we've been. So it's knowing the history, it's training them there. It's making sure that at every decision-making point, plea, sentence, reduction of charge, the whole nine, they're asking themselves, if this was a white person, would I think differently? Because I've seen that at this office as a defense attorney, the immediate labeling of people. Five young boys, black boys, leave a rap concert, they get into a fight, they're labeled gang members. And what I want to tell these assistants is, okay, if this were five white boys leaving SPAC, what do you think would happen to them? Would they be called gang members? Would they be offered jail time? No, they would be given disorderly conducts and told to go home. And so it's a real, Sean, it's a real commitment. It's not going to be easy, but you got to commit to it. And the reality is the DA's office here has not at all.
No, you touched on this, but it's a question I want to make sure I ask you. So, I mean, how do you, as Albany County District Attorney, take the bias out of the system?
You know, taking bias out of the system, I don't want to say it's impossible, but what I want to say is we're going to acknowledge it at every decision-making point in the system. And so by acknowledging it, by being vocal on it, by discussing it openly, by having, again, lawyers of color, lawyers from different backgrounds, we are focused on these biases and that we are acknowledging them and making sure we're not making decisions on them. And in fact, doing quite the opposite, making sure we're being more fair. I mean, this is also about equity, too. You know, it's about equity. I mean, you got marijuana offenses. You know, this is facts, too. I'm sure you could spew out, but 70% marijuana arrests are black and Hispanic people, you know, but meanwhile, you know, white people smoke marijuana at the same rate. So it's like acknowledging these biases, it's going further, it's going back. It's saying, you know, we have entrepreneurs making millions off of marijuana. We got to look back at marijuana convictions, people in jail currently serving marijuana sentences, calling on the governor to commute those sentences, moving to resentence in the DA's office. It's about bringing equity to the system, not just like fairness, not just acknowledging the bias. Yeah, we got to do that, but we got to go further. We got to go back and undo what those biases had done in the past proactively.
right. This next one is on the special prosecutor. Following the murder of George Floyd and just weeks before the June 23rd primary, your former boss announced that he was, quote, urging Governor Andrew Cuomo to expand and codify laws assigning special prosecutor assignments in all new cases where members of law enforcement are accused of a crime or misconduct. But as you just touched upon, back in August 2018, after an Albany police detective shot Elazar Williams in the back, paralyzing the 19-year-old, Soares ignored calls from the community to recuse himself from that officer-involved shooting. Governor Cuomo's say-their-name agenda currently before the state legislature includes designating the state's attorney general as an independent prosecutor for deaths of unarmed civilians caused by police. So was David Soares' June 1st request of Governor Cuomo to assign a prosecutor to every officer-involved criminal case a politically expedient move just 3 weeks out from the primary?
Yes. This is a reactionary move to remedy a history of regressive policies. He's taking a position now. It's not proactive, progressive leadership. He waited two full days and then only condemned George Floyd's killing after there was property damage. And now he seeks to capitalize on the Black Lives Matter movement by calling for special prosecutor reform to cover his own tracks of failing to call for one in Elazar Williams' case. So David Soares is not being a leader. He's not being an advocate for this community. He is a politician capitalizing on a moment of pain in the community. It's insulting.
How should the prosecution of police crimes be handled?
Well, they need to be handled swiftly, okay? And so if there is a shooting of a civilian by a police officer, you immediately call for the special prosecutor because, again, you're focusing on you want the truth in the process. You want the people to believe in the process, accountability, transparency. So if they think that there's a potential bias because prosecutors are too close to police officers, you call for the special prosecutor right away. And you can do that yourself. You don't need to wait for the governor to appoint someone. The county law here in Albany County provides for that. I've served as a special prosecutor a number of times in burglary cases, robbery cases, DWIs, forcible touchings, the whole nine yards. So the DA can always call for a special prosecutor, but that's not to say that we're not going to take police misconduct seriously. We're also talking about the repeal of 50A. Actually, I think the legislature is putting that forward today. Another reform that should have happened quite a ways back. This shields officer records. And so at that point, you have police officers potentially with prior misconduct, again, accusing people of crimes, potentially leading to the loss of liberty when they potentially are not credible and that you have some bad actors. And so in my office, I've said, I've been vocal from the beginning. I'm repealing 50A, but I'm going to have a police misconduct database, and I'm going to make that publicly available. So my staff's going to be keeping track of any officers that we know lie on the stand, have lied in paperwork, have engaged in misconduct. We are going to keep track of that. And they do this in New York City. They do it in Chicago. They do it in San Francisco. And what you find is it is a small percent. I mean, it's like 5%, 10% of the officers on a force, are actually on these lists. And so I think even police officers today are saying to themselves, like, I don't want this type of reputation. I don't want to be associated with this. We don't want these bad actors hiding behind some shield. And so, that's how you address police misconduct, both proactively and also if there's police brutality, you're making sure that you're focusing on truth in the process, transparency, calling for that special prosecutor. And I'll just bring up one last example. You brought up the Elazar Williams case, right, where the DA's office really insulated the police department and walked the grand jury through that process, showed them one video when the other video clearly showed that the young man was shot in the back. Then you bring up the Luke Deere case where these officers attacked and beat violently with batons these people over on First Street here in Albany County. That case is just sitting right now. And so to me, it just is like, again, sources eroding. He's eroding the faith in the justice system by all these flip-flopping in positions, how he's handling cases one way and the other way. He's talking about victims. He had two incarcerated women raped by a CO. That case was dismissed on speedy trial grounds. It sat there for 8 months. So what I want to get across here, Sean, is, you know, again, this is a very important job. It's very important how you do it. You need to be proactive with it. You need to focus on what's important. And I think that Soros has for too long focused on the politics of the job.
Well, by its nature, it's a political job. I mean, you are, and this has been brought up, I'm sure, endlessly to you, you are where Soros was 16 years ago. You're running against the entrenched incumbent. I mean, there's a reason why people are constantly running against an entrenched incumbent. I mean, people love Bernie Sanders because he's a radical, but he has about as much meaningful legislation passed as you or I. So, I mean, you got to get along to go along. So, I mean, how can you actually get these things done when you actually have to work with these police and these other people who are not going to want to go along with the types of things that you want to do?
Yeah, so it's a great question. First, I would say the only similarity between Soros and I is that he was 34 when he first ran. I'm 34 now. I have the Working Families Party endorsement. He had it then. But the difference here comes down to the actual lawyering experience. I've tried cases as a prosecutor. I've tried cases as a defense attorney. I've been appointed a special prosecutor. I clerked for the third department here, the appellate judges in Albany. I was hired by the late Anthony Cardona. I have handled appeals on both sides, prosecution, defense. I have handled complex commercial civil cases in state Supreme Court, the commercial division. And this is what I would describe as a unique legal experience because I've seen the justice system from all sides. But beyond that, I'm going to take a step back here because this, you know, it's about my experience, but it's also about what I view as leadership. And I view leadership the way that we work at my law firm, which I help manage. And that is through a team approach. And so on my team, I have retired judges. I have former prosecutors that left that office for similar reasons as me. I have public defenders who are supportive. And I have lawyers that have worked on these legislative issues, former counsels to the governor himself that are supportive of my campaign. And so I'm going to be bringing in a very deep, experienced bench across the legal spectrum here. And that's a key difference between Soros and I. He came from within the system. I left. I resigned from that office, and I was a defense attorney for a while, civil litigator, and also appointment as a special prosecutor. Now, to work with the and not just Bernie Sanders. I mean, I'm tossing Working Families Party, Barbara Smith, Zephyr Teachout's going to endorse here shortly. I mean, so that list is growing, and the local electeds are going to get behind here shortly because at this point, and you can listen to the debates, and I hope you do, or you reference them in this article, Legal Women Voters. Soros is literally talking about what he did in 2005. He is trying to dust off old programs that he came up with 16 years ago to promote them to the public in an instance of an emergency when people are protesting in the streets because we have waited for far too long for reforms to this criminal justice system that he waits to call for after these issues that people call for become emergencies. It is not proactive leadership. It's not proactive at all, and you must be in criminal justice. To work with the local police departments, I know many of the officers. I knew them from when I was a prosecutor. They always respected me, and I think they will still respect me. I hope they join me in where criminal justice needs to go. I don't view them as an enemy. I am just not going to accept misconduct in the police department or officers that come to my office and lie, and I don't think that they're going to fault me for that. And in terms of charging decisions. If I choose to say, you know, these cases, these low-level cases, these cases that really punish poverty, that really punish mental health or substance abuse issues, we're going to divert these. These aren't our focus. But guess what, officers? We are really focused on serious crime. And this actually will free up more time to focus on that. And that'll actually make us more safe. So, again, I hope to build partnerships with all the local police departments in this shift in criminal justice that is occurring across the country, and that I plan to help bring to Albany County, be a part of that and the shift that people are demanding across the board in the streets in this country.
That shift you're talking about, I mean, I know you're familiar with Ms. Rollins in Suffolk County. I mean, she was took office in January of 2019. By August of 2019, you know, one-fifth of her staff had left the office. I mean, she gets pushback from a lot of these people. So, I mean, do you expect anything different than, I mean, the roadblocks that these types of prosecutors like Ms. Rollins and the gentleman in Philadelphia are kind of running into?
I can speak to Philadelphia. I'm a bit more familiar there. I mean, Larry Krasner took over as a DA in Philadelphia, and he, you know, a lot of the leadership left, which I think is to be expected. I mean, you have a change in leadership, a change in priority culture. You need people that you know are with you on that. So I expect a change in leadership, which I think is pretty it's pretty expected. And I plan to bring in new leadership, experienced leadership from different backgrounds of the legal profession, like I already previously mentioned. But I think a lot of the staff stayed there. A lot of the staff stayed there. And I hope to have a similar experience here. Honestly, probably bringing back some staff members that, like I said, left for similar reasons that I did that also are consequentially lawyers of color. So I'm hoping to do that. Again, like I said, if people are committed there, they're committed to a different vision for this office, a different shift in criminal justice that's occurring. You know, I want people there. I need them. So I want to make clear to you, I don't see myself going in there and just rolling every head in that office, you know, but I do see a shift in leadership happening. I think it has to happen.
Okay, great. This next one's on discovery. Until last year, New York was just one of a handful of states whose prosecutors could hold evidence from defense lawyers until right before a trial started, a move that led a number of defendants to plead guilty to crimes without seeing all of the evidence against them. The overhauled law, according to Times, fundamentally transformed how trials are conducted in New York, moving the state from one of the most restrictive rules in the country regarding turning over the government's evidence to having one of the most open. The new law required district attorneys to turn over most of their evidence within 15 days of a defendant's first court appearance. There have been subsequent rollbacks, including extending discovery to 20 calendar days and making some information non-discoverable. Leading the charge against the original changes were the state's law enforcement and prosecutor organizations, who argued that the looser discovery rules would make it easier for defendants to intimidate witnesses, especially when it came to sexual assault and gang-related cases. Soares, as the president of the District Attorneys of New York at the time, became the public face of the criticism against the proposed law, which sought to do away with the, quote, trial by ambush. Soares told ProPublica in April of 2019, quote, while most New Yorkers were sleeping and enjoying the weekend, a handful of lawmakers with limited knowledge of the criminal justice system behind closed doors came to an agreement that will place unnecessary burdens on the workings of our criminal justice system and actually slow down the wheels of justice. The state asked the court system to perform the legal equivalent of an aircraft carrier pulling off a 180-degree turn in the Hudson River. So isn't Soares correct in his criticism? How wasn't this too much too fast?
No, he's not correct. It's just a regressive approach, and there's a lot to be unpacked there. So first of all, this change was in the works for some time. It was debated at the table for years. The advocates, the counsel to the governor, people in law enforcement, it was debated for years. They knew this was coming. This tactic of saying it was overnight is just a simple way to push to make progressive legislation fail. And you brought up a good point about, you know, the fear-mongering. You're right. Soares rallied with Republicans, John Flanagan, to name one, a majority leader over in the legislature, that this was going to release information, that victims were going to be targeted. And you saw this down in Suffolk County, Long Island, where the police chief down there blamed the new law for a witness being killed, which turned out to be false, that information didn't come anywhere from the justice system. And so you have people participating, promoting fear-mongering, trying to make these discovery laws fail. Soares was a part of that, and it's not true. The reality is, if you look at the law and you actually focus the media on the truth of the law, is that you didn't have to give victim information. What you had to provide was adequate contact information, which could have been an email address, which could have been like these Google phone numbers you can create. It's not an address. It's not a personal home phone or a personal cell phone. You could just create an email address. I mean, so there were perfectly fine ways. It's just so the lawyer can follow through on his case, you know. And in terms of the changes, you know, this aircraft carrier example, there's no question that, you know, this new law means a lot more work for law enforcement and prosecutors, but at the same time, change always takes more work, and it's always difficult, but nothing worth doing doesn't take hard work, and it's going to take time, it's going to take discomfort, but again, that's how change comes. You don't just fear-monger about it and try to make these laws fail, and honestly, here's the other issue here that was not highlighted in the media. This new law that said that you had to turn over evidence faster and witness information quicker also made it easier for prosecutors to call for a protective order, which means that they could ask the judge to, issue an order of protecting any information they didn't want to disclose. It made that easier. And ultimately, let's take a step back here, Sean. Let's go 20,000, 30,000 feet. What was the real purpose of this law? The purpose was because you had prosecutors, you had people in this DA's office, I've experienced it, you can ask any local defense attorney about it, they would dump evidence on the last minute. They dump evidence the weekend before trial. In that same case, the Kaleem Lewis case, they try to dump a bunch of video evidence on me the Sunday before the Monday trial, which I luckily moved to preclude, and I was granted that. You look at the Snyder case, this rape case that was dismissed recently, the two female incarcerated people raped by a CO, case dismissed. That case was dismissed on speedy trial because the prosecutors weren't ready in 8 months because they didn't go out and collect the evidence that they needed to, that they constitutionally had the duty to do, to turn over. So the purpose of this new law, Sean, is that it put more diligence in the process. It made sure prosecutors were taking the job seriously, focusing on turning over evidence, which makes the accused review it quicker and resolve cases faster. They're either going to plead quicker or they're going to go to trial quicker. It speeds up the justice system. It makes it more fair. And so it was completely, I don't want to call it unacceptable, but, you know, it was unacceptable that Soares participated in the fear-mongering campaign, you know, with Republicans.
Isn't that just him working across the aisle?
It's working across the aisle to make legislation fail that actually passed across the aisle. So he went across the aisle to make legislation fail. You know, so that legislation was passed across the aisle. It was fully supported by the public, too. If you go back before it was passed, I think Siena did a poll, and people were in support of all these reforms, like 60 to 70%. But then, of course, once the fear-mongering campaign went out, that's when Soares went across the aisle when he participated in the fear-mongering. That's when people were like a bit wary about it. And the reality is, you know what the truth was? People were returning to court. That's just not as newsworthy as these other cases that they cherry picked out for the media to to fearmonger about.
All right, great. This last question is on sexual assault. According to the most recent data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is from 2018, 75% of rape and sexual assault crimes were never reported to police. The Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, citing the Bureau's National Crime Victimization 2010 to 2016 survey, states that for every 1,000 sexual assaults, 230 were reported to police, of which just 46 led to an arrest, which translated into just 5 felony convictions. An estimated 140 rapes were reported to law enforcement in 2018, according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program. In New York State in 2018, there were 6,574 rapes reported, but only 933 related arrests. In the Albany-Troy Metropolitan Statistical Area, which is made up of Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga, Schenectady, and Schoharie counties, there were 334 rapes reported. In the city of Albany specifically, 52 rapes were reported to law enforcement in 2018. However, only 6 were cleared. A uniform crime reporting designation, meaning that the enforcement agency reported the offense as cleared by arrest or solved for reporting purposes. Why does Albany County prosecute just a fraction of rape cases?
This is a deeper question about the justice system as a whole. Again, take a step back, and you have those stats are right on the money. What is it about the justice system that the majority of people that experience sexual assault that are victims, they don't even want to come forward to this justice system? What is it about the justice system that the people that they do come forward or they're asked to come forward, they don't really stay involved and those cases aren't closed? And then what does it say? Here's a step forward here. What does it say about the justice system, about the people that come forward, testify, cases are closed, and they leave this justice system with a very low satisfaction of what just occurred? We are not doing enough here to support victims of these crimes. And you take an overall step back here. This is, people don't want to come forward because they don't feel like the justice system works out for them. You know, because a lot of times, Sean, people who have been harmed have caused harm. And so some of these victims may have also been accused before. And so their whole sense of faith in the system of fairness and that it's going to work is deteriorated. And so that's just a huge overall problem. In Albany County, you know, look, I can't speak to the specifics, or all I can say is that when you see headlines in the Times Union of rape cases being dismissed on speedy trial grounds because they sat there for 8 months, that doesn't drive a whole lot of faith in the justice system either. So people probably aren't coming forward because they see that, you know, the result, the work that they're going to put in to come in, to testify, to meet with prosecutors could all be for naught. If prosecutors aren't focused on the importance of those cases, which, you know, the Snyder case is a highlight. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I mentioned it several times at this point, people be Snyder. But, you know, I want to sort of take a moment to sort of to just kind of tell you, I think this is the key difference between myself and this opponent. You know, when we're asking questions about, like, why isn't it working right now, like specifics, we're taking a step back. Why is this whole system not working, and how is it going to work better in the future? You know what I mean? Like, we're not focusing on the deeper questions here we need to address. That's how you get to the systemic issues in the system. And it's not easy. Look, I'm not sitting here like I'm a savant. I'm not sitting here like I have all the answers. What I'm saying is that I'm committed to a different approach. I'm committed to a lot of reform that people have been demanding in the streets, that I ran on in February, that caused me to run, that people have been asking for years. And I don't, you know, I don't need to come up with all my own policies here. Progressive prosecution has worked in San Francisco. It's worked in Philadelphia. You mentioned Boston, Eric Gonzalez in Brooklyn. you know, serious crime, violent crime is down in these cities, and people are more safe because of the shift in the approach to criminal justice that's occurring in those cities, which is the approach I'd like to bring to Albany County. I mean, I know that's sort of a big sentence, but, you know, it's a general when we're zooming out here.
I mean, does that involve bigger budgets? I mean, what is that? How do you do that?
No, it doesn't involve bigger budgets. It involves using the huge budget that the DA's office has. I mean, it's a massive budget over there, and what it involves is like, okay, we got 6 investigators or 10 investigators on the DA's office staff. Do we need all these people? We have a fleet of black vehicles out there, of huge Suburbans. Do we need these vehicles? We understand that the war on drugs, the failed war on drugs, that we're not going to keep fighting that in Albany County. Currently, the DA's office incarcerates nonviolent drug offenders at the same rate it incarcerates violent drug offenders. So we know they're still fighting the failed war on drugs there. So what it is we're not putting a lot of resources into this unit. We're putting more resources into this unit. And so it's a shift in the resources you have. What about all the money that comes in from the seizures? Where are we putting that? And really, it's not even just a shift of budget within the office. I want to shift some of that money outside of the office, and not just to a few hand-picked people like the DA's office. And you're not even going to have to ask me a question about this, because, again, this is about transparency. If you're asking a question about what the DA's office does with its money, you should be asking why isn't the DA's office transparent. Pop that on the website. Here's where I'm investing money from the resources of the DA's office. These schools, okay? These programs, this youth program. I mean, you know, that's really where it's at, not just a few hand-picked, cherry-picked places. So it's a shift in your current resources. You can advocate for more resources, but I'm not going to be trying to expand. A bunch of line prosecutor staff. Again, I'm trying to put the resources where they better serve the community in a better way, a different way, you know, as I've talked about before about public safety.
Well, should the DA's office do anything to work with police and hospitals to make it easier for rape victims to report their crimes?
I mean, should the DA's office do that? I mean, the simple answer here is yes. But the harder question and the harder answer is, again, why don't people feel comfortable talking to police officers about being victims of crime? Why don't people feel comfortable talking to prosecutors about being victims of crime? That just simply goes back to the fact that a lot of times the people that have been harmed cause harm. Sometimes they've been accused. And regardless, they've seen how this justice system works. It only works for some people. It really doesn't work for a whole slew of other people. And so it's about bringing faith to the system. So, you know, again, I believe that this culture shift that needs to happen, I believe that shifting the resources that need to happen, a different approach that needs to happen. The whole purpose of this whole thing is to make it more fair for everyone and to put more trust in this system that clearly people don't trust right now. They're marching in the streets about this. And so that's the deeper question you need to be asking with this question. You know, like, can we do some? Yes, of course. Should we? Yes, of course. But how do we do that? We got to zoom out here too, you know? It's a deeper issue here. I mean, these are longstanding issues. It's going to take some real work.
You know, so this January, you're in elected office. You've got 4 years. I mean, how do you bring back faith to an office where so many people are just completely put off or distrust by? I mean, you've got a short amount of time and a very long record to run against. I mean, what can really be done?
Well, I've already been starting to do that now during my campaign, meeting with the community leaders, meeting with people that have been involved in the justice system, both victims, people that have been formerly incarcerated, leaders in criminal justice in Albany County, like Dr. Alice Green, whose report showed that it was, you know, the amount of people of communities of color that trusted the DA's office is about 18% or 13%. I'm working on that now. And when I get into office, this is what I'm going to do because, you know, people want to say, hey, you always got a seat at the table. You know, the people that are asking for these reforms, they've been sitting at this table for years. The table is set. The menu is there with The reforms that they are calling for to bring more transparency and accountability to the justice system. So what I'm going to do right away is start advocating for those reforms, doing what I can to put them in place in my office. I don't need to wait for the legislator to act. And then of course, creating space for the community at my office, going out into space, listening to hard questions without easy answers. I just did that the other week. We had over 200, 300 people on a call, and they were just, you know, railing on the justice system. And you're right, I'm only one person. How much can I do? All I can say is that I'm committed to this. I worked extremely hard to get the campaign to this position where we've outraised the incumbent 16-year opponent, 2-1. But at this point, we've probably outraised them 4-1. This doesn't just happen. You know, it's been a lot of effort. I can tell you, after this June 23rd, I'm taking a week or two off. Then I got to start putting my plan into place, putting my people into place, so I can hit the ground running on day one and start regaining and building upon those relationships and the trust that I'm already doing, you know, now while I'm campaigning.
The money thing, just over the course of my research, I found the type of money that District Attorney Soares received from the Working Families Party in 2004. Are you expecting that type of backing?
Nope. I'm not being staked by the billionaire George Soros like he was when he won. When we did our last filing, we had 400 individuals contributed to this campaign, and we outraised them 2-1. So this isn't some flush of money from George Soros. It's been through people in this community that care, through people in the justice reform movement that care. You know, it's been through individuals. 400 individuals contributed to the campaign. If you look at his filing, it's mostly his staff. And I don't know if you saw also, you know, these dealers of assault weapons locally.
Mm-hmm.
7 of them contributed on the same day. That was a large source of his fundraising, $4,000.
I mean, you have, that's one thing, I mean, you have the single largest donation of the two of you guys, almost $5,000.
I have received a max donation of $4,700.
Yeah.
I don't think, yeah, so I've received $4,700, and that was actually from someone who was wrongfully convicted, spent 16 years in prison for a crime that he never committed, and the actual guilty party remained free and committed further crime. And so I'm definitely very proud to have the financial support of someone who's been involved in the criminal justice system, was wrongfully convicted in the justice system, and now fights for reform to the justice system on a daily basis. So that was, I'm very proud of that.